EU affairs ministers also met on Tuesday to lay the groundwork.
That's, I think, a very important message. And it's a very important message which comes in a special time where we see this renewed geopolitical rivalry, new global tensions.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted, "Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream." Not everyone is impressed, given the current state of the EU.
I'd say the Ukrainians would rather live than die. And I'd say now the notion that they want to die for any European dream is a bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc. In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework, but the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact the strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say a major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Saeed Purizap, London.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
What is happening today in Masafer Yatar is just as fundamentally a part of this phenomena as the ongoing repression and resistance in Sheikh Jarrah in Gaza and beyond, says Omar Zahza, member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, in an article published under the heading Masafer Yatar evictions enabled by British-born judge. Stay tuned for more. To Palestinians and their supporters, it is known as Masafer Yatar. To the fake regime of Israel, and in keeping with the aseptic detachment common to colonial regimes, it has been firing zone 918 since 1981, when then Agriculture Minister Ariel Sharon decided on that designation explicitly in order to force out the area's residents. Located in South Al-Khalil Hills, the area spans 12 Palestinian villages with nearly 2,800 residents whose livelihoods depend mainly on farming. Agricultural communities have lived on the 8,600 acres of land and called it home for generations. In 1999, the Zionist regime's army expelled 700 residents of the area, though they were able to return pending a final ruling. This decades-old attempt at ethnic cleansing is now entering a crucial phase. On May 4th, the Zionist regime's High Court issued a ruling enabling the expulsion of nearly 1,200 Palestinians from the area, including 500 children, a decision the UN said may amount to a war crime. On June 1st, the Zionist regime forces demolished two homes in Khirbet al-Fakhit and two storage sheds, as well as two homes in Khirbet Markaz, both part of Masafer Yatar. In all, 21 people, including 9 minors, were displaced. 11 homes and workshops have been demolished since May ruling. Masafer Yatta puts on full naked display the cynical, oppressive, and overall colonial character of the ruling issued by David Mentz, a judge who lives in an illegal settlement in the West Bank, and the Zionist regime's actions. In the words of Nidal Yunus, head of the Masafer Yatta Village Council, the ruling was simply racist. The court decision is a racist decision taken by a settler judge. We have been fighting with Israel in the courts for the last 22 years, and it took this judge 5 minutes to destroy the lives of 12 villages and the people who are dependent on the land, unquote. Yunus regards the ruling as a continuation of the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Yunus has said, history repeats itself, Nakba after Nakba. This helped throw into focus how a major injustice has become entrenched. British-born Mentz wields total life divesting power over those who are indigenous to the land. Through and through, the Zionist regime weaponizes interminency, an unresolved preponderance of settlers and settlements, really, colonizers and colonies, undeclared borders, de facto annexation against the indigenous population. The Zionist regime's main imperative is to displace no matter the cost. This is why the families of Masafer Yatta need to prove that their home is their home, and why this ostensibly simple, even mundane truth can be so arrogantly delegitimized by the labyrinthine logics of settler colonial law. Yunus' words also capture in exacting detail how the struggle of Palestinians in Masafer Yatta illuminates the overall anti-colonial character of the Palestinian resistance struggle as a whole, Nakba after Nakba. So long as Zionism, the Zionist regime's ideology, exists, it will continue to mean an alternating dance between colonial violence and the reactionary settler laws that justify it. And of course, there is the settler, the glorified squatter, the would-be colonizer fully supported and enabled by the fake regime of Israel, which in turn was founded by and is sustained through the very acts of violent theft, appropriation and racist dehumanization of this figure represents. What began as an apparent exception is inevitably codified into general policy by a settler colonial regime. Organizers and activists remain acutely aware that there is an added layer of cruelty in addition to the colonial process of expulsion from Masafer Yatta. As activist Hamdan Muhammad Al-Horaini has explained, it's not really about destroying the houses, it's about destroying the life. If the area can be entirely depopulated, the time during which Palestinians lived there can in turn be erased. This allows the Zionist regime's colonial repurposing to eventually be confirmed by a surface reality made possible by ethnic cleansing. Then there will be no sense of time, no possibility of history outside of the colonizer's claims. Indeed, to be Palestinian living in the extended present of ongoing Zionist settler colonialism means confronting time on many levels and in many ways. First, naturally, it means to continue finding oneself racing against time, as the Zionist regime and its military steal more land, prolong an inhuman blockade, raise more homes, and continue to execute, detain, and incarcerate Palestinians, fracturing intimate timelines of kith and kin. It also means to have colonial history weaponized against you as procedures and conventions set into place by a violent settler regime become their own repetitive reference points, justifying Palestinian dehumanization and dispossession. The ongoing struggle to save Masafer Yatah encompasses all of this, but the story of Masafer Yatah is not just the greater story of Palestinian dispossession. It is also the greater narrative of Palestinian resistance. The entire regime of Israel can't remove me. We will not leave. We will not get out of here because we are the inhabitants of the land, Palestinian farmer Khaled al-Jabarin has declared. The phrase Nakba after Nakba reminds us the Nakba was not a moment in time. It is an ongoing process, a process against which Palestinians continue to rise up. This is a phenomena as the ongoing repression and resistance in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah, in Gaza and beyond. The Unity Intifada of 2021 showed the world that Palestinians are rising up together regardless of location. This is why we must not only support the call to save Masafer Yatah in as many ways as possible, we must also see the fight to save Masafer Yatah as connected to the larger battle for defeating the Zionist settler colonialism and to free Palestine from the river to the sea.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhwe. It's deemed to be a major announcement from Iran's capital, Tehran. Iran and the European Union say the talks on reviving the 2015 Iran deal will resume in the coming days. Yet what is not said here is why there was a break in the talks in the first place, namely how the U.S. prevented for the talks to actually progress. Another issue, whether the U.S. will make the or have the political will to make the decision, that is, lift sanctions and not lay down any new conditions. Just some of the angles we'll be discussing in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest for this program. Political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshchesh joins us from the capital, Tehran. Also joining us is political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Marseille in France.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will start with you first, Sayed Mostafa Khoshchesh, since you're here in the capital of Tehran, and I'm sure you saw the press conference. What do you think?
Hello, Kelvin. Thanks for having me. I'm not sure if you have my picture or not.
Yes, we do.
I believe you're just having my voice. Despite the very fact that some might see the development today as a major positive development since Borrell and the Iranian foreign minister both promised, imminent resumption of talks, I don't see much of a breakthrough here. That they were speaking in positive words, but there have been problems, some unresolved issues regarding removal of some sanctions that have remained on the table, and also with regard to some parts of the guarantees. These are two of the main issues that have remained unresolved. And, Iran presented its own initiative last month when Mora was in Tehran. They were happy. I mean, Mora and Joseph Borrell, after he went back to Europe, Borrell heard the Iranian initiative. They were happy. But as soon as they saw the reaction of the Americans, they were upset again. And those remaining issues are still over there, unresolved, while the Americans have stated that they would now remove the sanctions on the IRGC, as Rob Molly said during the Senate hearing last month. And the following day, the U.S. President Joe Biden said that the window of opportunity for giving any more merits in any, area has been shut down, meaning that basically there won't be any need for further talks. Because when you say that I'm not going to, give any kind of concessions, why should there be any kind of talks? So basically today, it was another case of Joseph Borrell's positive gesture in order to give some kind of momentum to the talks that have, been there at a standstill situation, and there's not been any major development. So he wants to push it forwards. He wants to set the stage and provide a positive atmosphere and give him momentum and bring the talks back to the headlines to see if there could be any progress in the talks.
Okay. Well, this is what the EU foreign policy, amongst many statements, has made there, Elijah Magnier. One of them, he said he was pleased a decision to resume the talks had been accepted both in Tehran and Washington. So the basic question comes here is that what did he do, or, as to use his word, facilitate? I'm not too sure what facilitate means. Maybe you can tell us that also, Elijah Magnier. But what did either Tehran or Washington, or should I say the EU also in that mix, make in order for this to resume?
The only way for the talk to move forward is for the U.S. to accept to give up some concessions and to offer some guarantee that Iran is asking. Unless Iran is ready to give concession from its sides, accepting that any deal can last for 2 years only, as long as President Biden is in power, accepting also that perhaps, or trusting that he's not going to implement other sanctions under different titles. So maybe that is the way for the deal to forward, even if it's not going to last for very long, because we don't know the identity of the next president. So we see Iran very adamant of asking for guarantee how this is going to be respected. And now Biden himself, before even ending his term, is not going to come back from the window and impose other sanctions on Iran under different titles and say this is not related to the JCPOA. So all these concern and lack of trust, this is why agreements are made to be signed. However, the lack of trust also in the U.S., because even if they sign an agreement, it doesn't mean they will abide by it, because we've seen not only the JCPOA revoked in 2018, but we also have seen treaties in Kaliningrad with Russia and the EU and other treaties are not respected and international laws thrown out of the windows. So when I hear Joseph Borrell saying this is against the international law, since when Europe has respected the international law, particularly related to the JCPOA, because it didn't respect its end of the deal. Not only the US, but the EU was afraid of honoring the deal. So I don't know how this is going to work out, and I am honestly, I doubt about it.
Well, it's very hard to understand Joseph Borrell, said Mostafa Khoshesh, when he gets on that podium, as he did today. I'm not trying to criticize him, but I'm just trying to understand what's going on. And he talks about how, the EU is going to be the facilitator and that he's very happy that these talks are going to progress. When just weeks ago at the EU Board of Governors, that was a different story, when that anti-Iran resolution was passed. How do you come, the Iranian side, how would they trust that entity called the EU through Borrell to then be optimistic to move forward? I mean, how does that work out?
Well, you're right. As a matter of fact, they've been, helping the United States to pressure Tehran, including their resolution at the Board of Governors of the IAEA. But they, at the same time, they try to pretend to be the middleman, the neutral party, which has never been the case. After the U.S. exited the deal and dropped out of the deal very illegally, they promised to make up for the lost interests, promised to Tehran. And they took Tehran and discouraged Rouhani's administration from taking reciprocal action for 14 months. They promised, they made promises, but they have never done anything. As a matter of fact, they've just been party to the deal when it was being endorsed. Otherwise, they've never been an independent party to provide Tehran with any kind of merit all throughout the past several years. They have never punished the United States. They had the possibility to work on legal mechanisms in order to, fine the companies, the private sector companies, to avoid obedience to the United States and encourage them to defy the U.S. Illegal unilateral sanctions against Iran. But they never did that. As a matter of fact, there have been more than 100 major EU state companies that could have worked with Iran even after the U.S. dropped out of the deal, but they never pressured the states in Europe. They never pressured their own state companies to stay under the deal and to work with Tehran. That's a breach, a significant breach of the paragraphs 25, 6, or 4 of the JCPOA. But let me remind you here that the U.S. seems to be very much adamant here to comply with, the undertakings that it has under the JCPOA, because for the last 3 months, there's been some kind of war of willpower between the two sides, Iran and the United States here, who are the main actors nowadays when it comes to the Vienna talks. And the Americans, after the Iranians invited Mora and offered him their new initiative, the Americans, they came forward and said that they would not grant any kind of concessions, not only with regard to the IRGC sanctions, but also with regard to other merits. They would not grant any kind of merit. And then they stopped, negotiations, and they went for, some kind of hybrid warfare against Iran, using media warfare, propaganda, encouraging riots, as well as, showing support for the opposition, the guys that have always been supported by the United States and the West, and they are based in Europe and in the United States. Also, they waged cyber attacks against Iran and supported Israel in that aspect. And also, they used Israel as a strategic partner for doing terror attacks and sabotage in Iran. And also, they ordered the seizure of Iranian crude cargo offshore Greece, which was reciprocated by Iran seizing two ships of Greece to show that enough is enough. This is not the Rouhani administration that was practicing appeasement policy. This is the revolutionary government of Raisi and who was elected to office and to power by those who were critical of Rouhani's appeasement policy, because, you know, tolerating the United States never ended up in any good result for Tehran. So Iranians voted for Raisi. So his strategy is active resistance diplomacy and showing power. So then they moved to the IAEA Board of Governors to use it also as a leverage, political leverage, diplomatic leverage against Iran. So as you see, it's a hybrid warfare. Using different means in order to pressure Tehran to step back. So it seems that Americans are not prepared, really, to go for real negotiations. They are just thinking of using pressure against Tehran, which has not been successful policy at all so far.
List of anti-Iran sanctions, anti-Iran actions there, Elijah Magnier, our guest, talked about. I'm curious if... they are under the impression that they're going to continue doing that if there was an agreement. I mean, is that, it seems like that's a line that they have followed and will continue to follow. Do you get the impression, again, we're speculating here, if there was any type of agreement that the U.S., along with Israel, and all the different anti-Iran actions that they've executed is something that's going to continue?
Look, it's very simple. Iran is increasing the weight, I mean, in kilos of the uranium. So it has reached 3,000, hasn't reached the 6,000 that used to possess in 2015. And Iran is threatening to remove more cameras. So far, 27 cameras were removed to blind a little bit the IAEA from some sites. At the end of the day, Iran is saying, I don't want the nuclear bomb, and I'm not going to make a nuclear bomb, and I am showing you some of my...
Okay, looks like we're having problems.
I understand that very well, and it's aware that you're not going to go beyond that, and because you're not going to go beyond that, it's not going to lift the sanction, and is blackmailing Iran to force it toward more concessions. This is why the West feels more tranquil about not giving Iran what it's asking, because you're not going to reach the nuclear bomb. That's it.
It's very interesting, don't you think, say, Mostafa Khoshesh, when you have a Borrell say, we are prepared to resume talks in the coming days. What is important for Iran is to fully receive the economic benefits of the 2015 accord. Something that was reiterated by the Iranian foreign minister, in which Borrell repeated, Iran has to receive the full economic benefits. But he's making that statement out of the capital, Iran's capital. Shouldn't he be in Washington telling the American side, lift those sanctions?
Exactly. That was what I wanted to say, as a matter of fact. He should be in Washington asking them why, if you're really up for a deal with Iran or talks with Iran, and then why did you declare that they would not remove the IRGC from the FTO list in the Senate hearing, and vice versa? You started saying that you would, I mean, Rob Molly said at the same Senate hearing that they would go for declaring more sanctions on IRGC. Now, this kind of action was even protested by Rand Paul at the same Senate hearing, saying, what kind of a negotiation is this? You say you would not grant any kind of merit to Tehran, and at the same time, you are adding up to your pressure. So this means that you're adamant to talks. You know, let's be honest. The Americans do not want a fair deal. And Joseph Borrell doesn't have the power, or maybe the EU is not willing at all, and it doesn't have the power either, to pressure the United States. So he's trying to convince Iran. Iran has presented this initiative last month. It's the United States that has been adamant to the initiative, the new initiative, and many others. And it's been the United States that has not been, you know, flexible. And it's the United States that's saying that it's not going to give Iran anything. So what kind of negotiation could be on the way when this is the case? As a matter of fact, the U.S. wants to pressure Tehran, to bully Tehran to step back. But they are coming to realize, especially after Iran's reactions, with regard to the seizure of its crude cargo, as well as to the IAEA Board of Governors resolution, which received Iran's tough response, they are realizing that this kind of maximum pressure policy that they condemn, but they still continue under Biden, would not end up in any kind of result for them. That's why they have sent Borrell to Tehran to soften Tehran's, you know, a voice and to encourage Iran to change direction. It reminds me of the same kind of action that they did when they were about to, you know, vote for a resolution at the Board of Governors. I mean, the three European countries as well as the United States. Iran said that it would reciprocate this action. Then they sent some, some parties to Iran to discourage Iran from taking reciprocal action. And they said if Tehran promises not to take any kind of hostile action, then the United States and Europeans would soften the tone of that Board of Governors resolution. Iranian response was simple. Whatever you do under the title of a resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors will receive Iran's response in proportion. No matter what kind of language you use, what kind of action you do, it would be reciprocated. So Tehran did that. As a matter of fact, Tehran not only dismantled 27 cameras that were there mounted under the JCPOA, though there are still many other cameras installed, working, operating under the NPT at all Iranian facilities. Iran also started couple of cascades of highly advanced centrifuge machines to show that it would answer and show reaction, tough reaction to any kind of hostile action to deter any further U.S. hostility. The Americans, I believe, have come to realize that this kind of bullying policy would not, you know, end up in good results. So they have asked Borrell to come to Tehran to, you know, discourage Iran from further reciprocal actions.
I'd like to find out from you, Elijah Magnier, whether maybe we're looking at a scenario that is a little bit different from what, say, Mostafa Khoshnesh talked about in terms of the EU vis-a-vis the U.S. And that is the fact that we're looking, obviously, at the conflict in Ukraine and how the EU is suffering immensely, much like the rest of the world, really, but in terms of the energy shortages that they're facing, and whether there is an incentive for the EU to want Iran to come back to the foray, to come back to the scene, for them to want to purchase Iranian oil and in particular in gas. And that is something that the EU has to convince the U.S. of acceptance, because it's not the U.S. that's going to suffer as much as we're seeing the EU. Do you think that's a possibility?
Absolutely not, because what you're missing here, I've been hustled among the corridors of the EU commissions and decision makers. The EU is colonized by the US. Every single decision taken by the EU leaders comes from the US and looks after the US interest and not the European continent and the inhabitants' interest. We've seen that, as you rightly said, in the war in Ukraine, how the EU imposed sanctions on Russia, and we have inflation going out up the roof. And what's happening is we are paying the price of the wrong decision of our leaders in Europe. And regardless, the Americans are still saying you impose further sanctions. So all decision made by the EU come from the US. Josep Borrell would have never come to Tehran without the consensus of the US, and anything that Europe is saying is only seeking the U.S. interest in the first place. Of course, it is in the EU interest for Iran to return to the market, because we desperately need of oil and gas. So the energy lacking in Europe is obvious and going to be even worse in the coming month, and particularly when we go toward the end of the year. So the interest of the EU is not at stake here. Is only what the U.S. wants, and the EU doesn't have an opinion, really. And we've seen that from 2018 to today with the JCPOA, how Europe was incapable and impotent to do anything toward Iran to respect its deal.
My last question has to go on the statements made by Ali Shamkhani, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, which he's the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. Obviously, what he says needs to get a reaction on. Iran will further develop its nuclear program until the West changes its illegal behavior, further adding Iran's retaliatory actions in the nuclear sector are merely illegal and rational responses to U.S. unilateralism and European inaction, and will continue as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed. Your reaction, please, in less than a minute, please.
As I said, the Rouhani era is gone. Now Iran has been, left with one single option after the U.S. illegal, irresponsible discarding of the nuclear deal. Tehran's trust has been ruined in any kind of deal with them. So Tehran has been left with one option, showing power, while the United States is at the end of the road of its maximum pressure policy, which is admittedly being a failure.
Okay.
Both governments, the Trump and Biden, have admitted that. Now Tehran has multiple options available in the missile industry, regional power, nuclear power, and many others, to increase leverage on the United States, and the global energy prices would soon rise again when purchases for fall arrive, and that would add up to pressure on the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Said Mostafa Khoshesh, political analyst, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier. Thank you from Marseille, France. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The New York laws struck down on Thursday, 23rd of June, required anyone wanting to carry a handgun in public to prove that they had a proper cause to do so. The decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen renders the law an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. We now present you an article written jointly by Ed Pilkington and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, U.S. Supreme Court Overturns New York Handgun Law in Bitter Blow to Gun Control Push. The U.S. Supreme Court has opened the door for almost all law-abiding Americans to carry concealed and loaded handguns in public after a conservative majority struck down a New York law that placed strict restrictions on firearms outside of the home. The governor of New York, a Democrat, said the ruling was not just reckless, it's reprehensible. Pointing to recent mass shooting incidents in New York and Texas, a leading progressive group called the ruling shameful and outrageous. President Joe Biden said this ruling contradicts both common sense and the Constitution and should deeply trouble us all. On the left, outrage is growing over the court's rightward march. Recently, the court handed down a ruling which attacked the separation of church and state. As soon as Friday, 24th of June, it is expected to undermine or remove the right to abortion, guaranteed since 1973, and to reduce the federal government's ability to cut emissions, contributing to the climate crisis. The New York law struck down on Thursday, 23rd of June, required anyone wanting to carry a handgun in public to prove that they had a proper cause to do so. The decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen renders the law an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. In his ruling, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, apart from a few late 19th century outlier jurisdictions, American governments simply have not broadly prohibited the public carry of commonly used firearms for personal defense. Nor have they generally required law-abiding, responsible citizens to demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community to carry arms in public. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, the New York law also violated the 14th Amendment, which made Second Amendment rights applicable to the states. President Biden pointed to the longevity of the New York gun laws and to past Supreme Court acceptance of the need to regulate gun ownership. President Biden said since 1911, the state of New York has required individuals who would like to carry a concealed weapon in public to show a need to do so for the purpose of self-defense and to require a license. More than a century later, the United States Supreme Court has chosen to strike down New York's long-established authority to protect its citizens. President Biden added, as the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia recognized, the Second Amendment is not absolute. For centuries, states have regulated who may purchase or possess weapons, the types of weapons they may use, and the places they may carry those weapons. The courts have upheld these regulations. President Biden noted, I call on Americans across the country to make their voices heard on gun safety. Lives are on the line. The ruling has profound implications for the safety and conduct of up to 83 million people in New York and seven other states plus Washington, D.C., with similar proper cause laws. They include heavily populated states such as California and New Jersey, which account for roughly 3 out of every 4 Americans. Just weeks ago, an 18-year-old carrying a legally bought assault rifle shot and killed 10 people in a racist attack on a supermarket in a majority black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York. Just 10 days later, another 18-year-old teenager broke into an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, and killed 19 children and 2 adults before being shot dead by law enforcement. Democratic and Republican senators have since agreed a framework for gun reform. On Thursday, 23rd of June, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, said the proposals did not lay one finger on the Second Amendment and would make the country safer. But any gun legislation inevitably faces strong headwinds, with the potential to blow all the way to the court. McConnell helped pack with conservatives. In his dissent to the New York ruling, Chief Justice Stephen Breyer, a liberal justice soon to retire, wrote, in 2020, 45,222 Americans were killed by firearms. Since the start of this year, there have been 277 reported mass shooting incidents, an average of more than one per day. Justice Stephen Breyer said, gun violence has now surpassed motor vehicle crashes as the leading cause of death among children and adolescents. Many states have tried to address some of the dangers of gun violence just described by passing laws that limit, in various ways, who may purchase, carry, or use firearms of different kinds. Justice Stephen Breyer added, the court today severely burdens states' efforts to do so. Rana Epting, executive director of the progressive group Move On, lamented a shameful and outrageous decision, adding, the conservative-packed Supreme Court, in concert with Republicans in Congress, is ensuring our schools, our grocery stores and our churches will continue to be targets of violence and not the sanctuaries and safe places they should be. The court has steadily undermined gun laws, recognizing a right to keep guns at home for self-defense in 2008 and extending that right 2 years later. In the New York case, two men sued the state. Under the proper cause law, the men could secure unlimited permission to carry concealed guns in public only if they could demonstrate a special need for self-protection. Lawyers argued that carrying a firearm outside of the home was a fundamental constitutional right. It is not the same extraordinary action that requires an extraordinary demonstration of need. Civil rights and gun safety groups attempted to sway the court. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, argued that lifting controls on guns in public places would harm First Amendment rights such as assembly, association, and speech. Gun control advocates warned that scrapping the law could hit relations between the police and citizens because anyone in contact with law enforcement would be more likely to be legally armed. On Thursday, 23rd of June, the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, said, "The Supreme Court is setting us backwards in dealing with gun violence. This decision is not just reckless, it's reprehensible." Kathy Hochul also said she was prepared to call the legislature back into session to deal with this. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, said she would not be deterred from standing up to the gun lobby and their repeated efforts to endanger New Yorkers. A leading representative of the gun lobby, Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association, NRA, joined Republicans celebrating a watershed win and said, "The right to self-defense and to defend your family and loved ones should not end at your home." But Keechan Sewell, the New York City Police Commissioner, warned gun owners, "If you carry a gun illegally in New York City, you will be arrested. Nothing changes today." Rana Epting of Move On said, "It is hard to imagine a Supreme Court more out of touch with the people. Common sense policies to reduce gun violence are supported by 9 out of 10 Americans. This court is now nothing more than the political arm of the most extreme elements of the Republican Party." Pointing to Mitch McConnell's unprecedented denial of even a hearing to Barack Obama's third nominee, Merrick Garland, now Attorney General, and the confirmation of 3 justices under Donald Trump, Rana Epting said, "Republicans stole seats and packed this court to enact what voters have repeatedly rejected at the ballot box. It is far past time we expand the court, reform it, and restore balance to our judicial system."